You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, May 16th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Sandra Steingraber, author of Raising Elijah, Protecting Our Children in an Age of Environmental Crisis. Just recently out of prison for her protests, her anti-fracking protests. Also on the program today, some stuff that's scandalicious. Not too much, ladies and gentlemen. We will talk about the SHIELD law to be reintroduced following its failure in the Senate years ago as Benghazi begins to fade in the rearview mirror of, well, everyone except for everyone on the right. The acting head of the IRS fired yesterday by the Obama administration, as they have to pretend to take this IRS scandal, or they take this pretend IRS scandal seriously. Yesterday also marked the fifth city in the past almost month now, I think, that has enjoyed a strike of fast food workers. Also, a great tip for those of you who are very wealthy, want to go to Disney, don't want to wait in lines, and have absolutely no ethical or moral center. Jeremy Hammond still in prison while other members of ZolSec are sentenced yesterday. We will get to all that and more. Let me just do this story very quickly from the New York Post. This is really sort of stunning and gross. Some wealthy Manhattan moms and dads, for that matter, have figured out the key to bypassing the long lines at Disney World. Apparently, there are these black market Disney guides, which will get you to the front of the line. Now, one of the things you can get is, like, I guess apparently is a VIP guide and fast passes where you pay extra money to leave the little people behind. Something like $350 an hour for the Disney VIP guide. And you just cut into the lines. I've seen it. Been down there. They get special access. At the time, you think, like, is that, like, are they members of the Disney family? But there is, you can buy into that, apparently, the Disney family. But there is a black market tour guide, which is cheaper. And that is Dream Tours of Florida, where you hire Dream Tours guide who is disabled. And apparently, if you are disabled, if you need a wheelchair or a motorized scooter, you can bring up to six guests to a more convenient entrance. And so you've got wealthy folks hiring essentially handicapped tour guides who ride around in their motorized scooters. The rest of them are their family or pretend to be their family. A woman interviewed said she hired Dream Tours guide to escort her, her husband, and their one-year-old son and five-year-old daughter through the park in a motorized scooter with a handicap sign on it. The group was sent straight to auxiliary entrance at the front of each attraction. My daughter waited 1 minute to get on It's a Small World. The other kids had to wait 2.5 hours, crowed the mom. Ryan Clement runs Dream Tours guide towards Florida with girlfriend Jackie Cristiano, whom the rich Manhattan mom indicated was her family's guide. Working number for Cristiano could not be found, and Clement refused to put the post through to her. Message left on Facebook was not immediately returned. Clement denied that his gal pal uses her disability to bypass lines. He said she has an autoimmune disorder and acknowledged that she uses a scooter on the job. There you have it, folks.
Why would you even, like, tell people this stuff? Like,
well, that's right. I mean, if you're the one of these wealthy mom, you're just like, well, what's the problem? I just unlocked the key. Or unlock the lock. I've got the key. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Sandra Steingraber. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome Sandra Steingraber. She is the author of Raising Elijah, Protecting Our Children in an Age of Environmental Crisis, as well as Living Downstream and Having Faith, and also the subject of a documentary by the same name, Living Downstream. Welcome to the program, Sandra.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, your book is it really is fantastic. I have two young children myself. We have gone through much of the sort of the same processes that you speak of in terms of dealing with the many ecological threats to our children. But I want to start first with this concept that you talk about in your book, well-informed futility. Can you explain what that is?
Sure. That's a concept I introduced right at the beginning of the book, because I have come to believe it's our biggest problem for solving the very real environmental the very real environmental crisis that threatens the lives of our children. Of course, there are very many entrenched economic interests, the fossil fuel industry being one, that are at the source of the problem, but it's people's advanced resignation, their willingness to give up the fight before they've even enjoined it, that I find to be the biggest issue. People find this problem overwhelmingly depressing in a way that, you know, other problems like terrorism or a pedophile located in your community, all these other big and scary problems can swing us into action, but the idea that the world's plankton stocks are in trouble and therefore our oxygen supply is in trouble because plankton make us half the oxygen we breathe, and of course our kids need an oxygen supply, they need ice caps frozen to provide a normal weather pattern for them to grow crops, all these things cause our eyes to glaze over and cause us to be depressed. And so it turns out psychologists have a name for this phenomenon. It's called well-informed futility, and it refers to the feeling that we have when we learn about something that we feel that we have no agency over. So we hear about a terrible problem. We don't think there's anything we can do to fix it. And so it makes us feel so much unbearable grief or guilt or rage that rather than continue to feel that way, we start to turn away from more knowledge itself and then simply put our head in the sand and take a hear no evil, see no evil approach to it. It's very easy to do that when you have young kids because, of course, your job is to protect your children and not make them feel scared about something. And so you don't necessarily want to have a conversation about the fact that one in every four mammals is now going extinct because of climate change around the dinner table. And so because we don't want to talk about it in front of our kids, we parents end up not talking about it at all and live in this kind of infantilized happy bubble in which both, you know, bad news doesn't penetrate. And so that's the starting point of Raising Elijah. I want to march my readers right out of that bad place and make them feel that their action is actually going to make them feel better.
And it's interesting, too, because there's this, in many respects, the agency that we have is both in the context of what we can do as individuals to protect our individuals' families, but ultimately that's not really enough in some respects. In other words,
right. So I take it. Yeah. So here's where my biologist background kind of comes into play. So Raising Elijah is really two books in one. It's my life in this sort of sloppy ecology of my own household, where I'm, you know, a busy working mother with these two lovely children, one of whom Elijah is born and grows up, you know, in the course of the book. And so you look at, you know, you see my laundry cycle and my food chain and how my husband and I do things in our house. But I'm also then taking a look at larger biological data to ask questions like, okay, I have given up a lawnmower and I've changed it out for a rotary mower. And in so doing, it turns out it actually saves me time because I use it like a Nautilus machine in the gym. And so I can get my daily workout and get the grass cut at the same time. And so it works for me, and I'm actually, you know, not putting X amount of carbon into the atmosphere and not creating carcinogenic smog that my son who has asthma would have to breathe. So what if we all did that? Would that actually make a difference? And it turns out if you scale up our individual responses like that, it actually doesn't make much of a difference. We need much larger scale change that involves redesigning our communities, involves fossil fuel companies having a willingness to leave their assets, their proven resources, reserves of fossil fuels actually in the ground and a willingness to abandon that and go do something different. And so how can we bring about those kind of changes? So, you know, the book really ranges from me as a breastfeeding mother who's out there mowing the grass while my child is nursing under the tree to me as the biologist looking at these large-scale planetary data and thinking about how parents can join this big human rights movement that I see happening, which is a move away from this ruinous dependency on fossils, lighting them on fire to make our tea kettles whistle, and looking elsewhere for our sources of energy, namely looking at wind, water, and solar for running things.
You talk about it as a human rights struggle, and you you compare it to the the abolition of slavery in many respects, and talk about this because it's both in terms of the implications for us as individuals in our rights to not have what you call, I think, trespass by toxins, and also in terms of what it means for society, in that society has to make a decision on an economic level that is analogous to the one that we had to make with slavery.
Right. Well, that's well said. And so indeed, comparing our current situation to the abolitionist movement of the 1830s is a dominant part of the narrative of Raising Elijah, and it starts with the title itself. So my son is actually named Elijah, but his namesake, I named him after a childhood hero of mine, which is an Illinois abolitionist from the 1830s whose name was Elijah Lovejoy. And I was particularly moved by this. I mean, he's somebody that all Illinois school children used to learn about. He lived just down the Illinois River from where I grew up, and he was a writer and an author like I am. And living across the Mississippi from Missouri, which was a slave state, he saw the slave trade up close and personal. And it bothered him greatly, as it did a lot of people who lived in the free state of Illinois. But what really pushed him over the edge to abolitionist activism was when he became a father. So he had a two-year-old son, and his wife was pregnant with their second child, and his heart just broke open in seeing children sold away from their parents and families being broken up, knowing that how much parents, the kind of love, the big love that all parents have for their children. And so he faced a dilemma then, because he knew that then that slavery was an abomination, and he was committed to the for the rest of his life to ending this and dismantling this institution. But at the same time, it brought danger upon himself, because pro-slavery mobs started, you know, throwing brickbats through his windows. And so meanwhile, his two-year-old and his pregnant wife had to all sort of sleep in the same bed, and he had to sort of defend them. And he worried that if his life was lost, of course, then he wasn't really being a good father to his own children. And plus, all this abolitionist work was taking him away from making money and from being with his family and so on. So he wrote these personal letters to his mother about this dilemma he faced, that he had to do this as a father, and yet he was a terrible father for doing it. And so how to deal with that? And he finally decided that he was this larger need to recreate our nation's economy so his children could grow up in a place where no one was enslaved was really what he was called to do. So he was assassinated in the end, in his 30s, on his actually 35th birthday. He was buried and pumped full of 5 bullets by a pro-slavery mob who dumped his printing press into the Mississippi River, his home being in Alton, Illinois. And so, you know, he was martyred, and yet his words went on to inspire Harriet Beecher Stowe, Abraham Lincoln, John Brown, the Boston abolitionists, and so on. And so I really wanted to resurrect that spirit of abolition to say that, you know, there was a time in our history where people insisted that even though our economy was ruinously dependent on this institution, in that time it was slavery, there was personal wealth bound up, it kept the cost of goods low, kept us competitive in the world market, everyone kind of benefited from slave unpaid labor as consumers, whether you owned slaves or not, and yet somebody had to stand up and say, you know what, this is an abomination, it has to stop, and it has to stop now, and I don't care how much social unrest is created, and I don't care how much personal wealth evaporates in so doing, with immediate emancipation. And so I think our situation now is analogous, right? That I think we now have become enslaved to fossil fuels. It's having a ruinous effect on our climate, interfering now with our ability to have reliable grain harvests, interfering with pollination systems. All of these things our children need, and it's our job as parents to make sure they're there for them. And at the same time, as my colleague Bill McGibbon says, it's as though we're mounting a movement against ourselves. It's as though the slave owners are leading the abolitionist movement, because all of us depend on low cost of gas, oil, and coal. Our retirement accounts are invested in it. We heat our homes with it and so on. And so we're in a really vexing and tricky situation. And mounting a human rights movement is the kind of the way out of it, is what I argue in Raising Elijah.
And in some respects, I mean, you have, I mean, it's clear how you have resolved that or maybe you haven't resolved it. It's ongoing, but that the ambivalence between being there for your kids and but also in some ways, I guess being there for your kids in sort of a way that is more abstract, or one in which, maybe abstract's the wrong word, but one which affects society at large, but in some ways may inhibit your ability to be there for your kids at that moment. I mean, I'm thinking last month, I mean, I imagine you just recently got out of prison. I mean, about 2 weeks ago.
I did, yes. And actually, I'm talking to you today from Norman, Oklahoma, where I am teaching a class. In fact, I just left my class where we were just talking about all these issues, teaching an honors class in extreme energy extraction and environmental health. And I felt compelled to come to Oklahoma, you know, just down the road here from some of the world's biggest oil and gas industry. Some of my students are petroleum engineering majors, and yet they, you know, my class was over-enrolled. There's this deep need to learn about and talk about these issues, but being here this week certainly takes me away from my own children who are in New York, and as you suggest, I also recently got out of jail for having done an act of civil disobedience which I felt called to do in my work to halt the expansion of the infrastructure for fracking, which is a technique that is blowing up the bedrock of our nation in order to bring hydrocarbon gases like methane, which is natural gas, but also propane and butane, which are now being stored under the lake near which I live, which is a source of drinking water for 100,000 of us. And so that was where I planted my own flag of civil disobedience and went to jail. And it'll actually gave, you know, every year I do an Earth Day lecture. I'm always somewhere talking on Earth Day. This year I was delivering my Earth Day lecture from cell number one at cell block 5D in the Chemung County Jail in the southern tier of New York. But I feel like that was the most important scientific statement that I could make. And as I told my children before I went to jail, you know, mom's on the job. I mean, it is my job to make sure that my children are protected from harm and they have a future. They can't have a future if the planet's climate system is wrecked to the point where they can't have stable food anymore. So just in the same way that it's my job to make sure there's money for them to go to college and, you know, they get to their piano lessons on time and all the rest, and wear their bike helmets when they ride their bike because they protect them from dangerous situations. The situation that we face with fossil fuels has become very dangerous, not only because of things that have happened within my lifetime, but the fact that other generations before me have failed to mount a challenge that's sufficient to the task, so that we now face, you know, because of a cumulative effect here, we face these calamitous tipping points and a big cliff of calamity that we're about to go over. And that it's my job as a parent, not only as a biologist, but also as a mom, to stop that. So I have told my children that there may be a time when I can be a better mother to you inside of a jail cell than outside, and I realize that will cause you to cry, but I'm hoping that your tears will be less than the tears of all children and grandchildren to come if we don't take action. And what I say in Raising Elijah about all that, which of course was written before I actually put on the orange jumpsuit and went to jail, but I was sort of anticipating that day might come as I wrote, what I say about all that is, you know, this is not that unusual, that when I look back in history, starting with Elijah Lovejoy, there were all kinds of parents who loved their children just as much as we do, who were just as busy, who worked just as hard, and had to balance, you know, buying the costume for the school play with the report that's due tomorrow at work and the kid who's homesick and throwing up all night while you're trying to, you know, get your house redecorated. I mean, these are things that have always gone on. And yet there have been parents, whether Elijah Lovejoy or in the case of my dad's generation, people who fought against the rise of global fascism, who had to work against Hitler at great risk to themselves and at risk to their own children, and had to send their children away, in some cases, to grow up away from them so they didn't, in case they were caught, they didn't, you know, put their children's lives at jeopardy. Well, now there is no safe place to send our children. The whole planet is in jeopardy. And so we might have to send ourselves away, you know, to be apart from our kids in order to be a better parent to them. Yeah. My own life, I have a great marriage. And so, you know, my work is made easier by the fact that my husband and I co-parent. And as Jeff says, you know, that's why kids have two parents in case one of them has to go to jail. So we're making it work, and I hope my story is inspiring in some way to others.
I should note that you specifically decided not to pay a $350-some-odd fine, but instead chose to head to jail for, I guess it was, ended up being 10 days. Why do you call the statement that you made about Earth regarding Earth Day from jail an important scientific statement?
Well, I think that two things. First of all, that the specific problem which I was addressing, which is the threat to drinking water by the storage of explosive hydrocarbon gases in salt chambers beneath and under the lake, as well as the attendant air pollution created by the compressor stations, the truck traffic, all the diesel machinery and so on that runs all that, as the, sort of this massive industrialization of an otherwise pristine body of drinking water, that if I could solve the problem as a scientist by letting the data speak, I would have happily done it. I believe that science should tell us how to do things. And so I have testified about this problem. I have submitted petitions and so on. And there are at least three different government agencies who are in charge of regulating and making decisions, yes or no, about what can go on with this facility on Seneca Lake. And one of them is our State Department of Environmental Conservation in New York, and then there are two other federal agencies. And so I have communicated with all of them. The problem is that the company itself is claiming that the data about the structural integrity of the salt caverns and the underlying geology is a trade secret. And so I don't have access to that information. Nobody does. And we have, some of our best journalists have tried through Freedom of Information Law request to get a hold of it, and it was redacted. And so if the companies privatize the knowledge, then how can those of us in the scientific community offer informed comment to our decision makers about the wisdom or folly of burying explosive gases underneath a source of drinking water? That's what frustrated me. And also then, speaking now as a mother, Elijah himself was born in this place. So the west bank of Seneca Lake, there used to be a birth center there that right around 9/11 he was born. So I became a mother of a son just as this terrible act of terrorism was happening. And so for me, the west bank of that lake with the frog sounds was the place in the midst of all this chaos that our country was about ready to plunge into, and all the horror of all that, was this beautiful refuge. It was his birthplace. That's where the bank of that lake is where I walked while in labor with him and delivered him. And so it's a sacred and important place. And so the idea that this is being ruined and industrialized for the purpose of carrying on a fossil fuel addiction made me feel in a motherly way like, look, I came to this place and did this very physically athletic and intense thing. I gave birth to a 10-pound baby boy without any anesthetic right on the bank of this lake. So now I'm going to take my body back to the same place and place it in front of a compressor station and blockade it. And then I'm not going to pay the fine, because that's the problem, right? The same company has been in violation of its maximum discharge into the lake. It discharges chemicals into the lake, and every quarter for 12 quarters, it exceeds the legal amount, and it simply pays a fine for the crime and walks away. So for me to say, I don't believe in paying fines to excuse a crime, so therefore you'll have to put my body in jail. So I'm going to take my body now that gave birth to the sun and then stood out in a blizzard and blockaded the site. Now I'm going to do something, a third extreme thing with my body, which is to put it in a jail cell. And that will be, I will let my body speak, because you're not letting me speak as a scientist, because you're not giving me access to the data. So that was kind of the framework for my Earth Day message this year.
And in the book, you also say that fracking is the single largest environmental threat to children's health. Explain that to us.
Sure. So of all the different industries that I have looked at and the kinds of challenges to our public health that they create, over the last 20 years, as an environmental health scientist, I've looked at everything from the ability of the pesticide atrazine to alter the timing of puberty in girls. I've looked at the ability of air pollution to shorten human gestation and increase the risk for preterm birth and how that contributes to infant mortality and so on. But of all the things I've looked at, I've never seen a bigger emerging threat than fracking. And that's because this is an industry that does two things that I don't know that any other industry does. First of all, it's exempt from most of our federal environmental laws. So it gets a pass. It doesn't have to report all the chemicals it uses, unlike all the other industries. So we have laws on the books, right, that say that if you're going to put an inherently toxic chemical into the environment that we all share, let's like say our air or our drinking water, you have to tell the public if that chemical leaves your factory walls and goes out into the environment. You have to report that to our government. But the laws are suspended for fracking, so it has a deliberate exemption from all these laws. So I can't get my hands on the data. We don't collect the data. We don't have emissions data. We don't have right to know for me to actually determine what the impact on health is going to be from fracking. And then the second thing is that I don't know any other industry that can use our land as its factory floor. There's no zoning. There's no separation. So in order for oil or natural gas to be blasted out of the shale bedrock a mile below our feet, the oil and gas industry sets up shop right on our private land, right in our community, sometimes next to daycare centers, in neighborhoods, on our farm fields, and so on. And so this is an industry that's not sort of away from where we live. It's scattered all over. And in order to work, of course, it has to tunnel sideways through the bedrock, shatter it, and pump it full of sand, water, and toxic chemicals to get these tiny bubbles of gas that are trapped in there, kind of like a spill of petrified champagne, if you will, to get those to flow up and out the borehole. And while they do that, while the hole is being drilled, all kinds of other toxicants that are trapped inside our bedrock, things like radon, benzene, that are just naturally down there, but they're not hurting anybody as long as they stay entombed, those things are also emancipated along with the natural gas. And so each one of these wellheads is kind of like a chimney in the earth where you get these hazardous air pollutants that are released. And we can do a little bit with regulations to try to capture some of that, but in fact, a lot of it is released before the well is even hooked up to the pipeline. And of course, cement, which is what is the liner for the well, is not an immortal substance. So it cracks, it shrinks, we all know what kind of old crumbly cement looks like. And so the cement is supposed to serve as an immortal barrier forevermore between the harmful chemicals that are trapped in our bedrock and then our underlying drinking water aquifers. But we know that, in fact, gas wells leak. 6% of them leak right away. And over time, as those well casings age and begin to crumble, they become like people that have osteoporosis, right? And they tend to crack and fracture. And so then you have pathways for these inherently toxic substances to find their way up to us, either through air or water. Over what time period, we're not even sure. But this it concerns me greatly that we may be laying time bombs in the earth that may not only affect us, but future generations as well. So this is worrying about fracking and not only studying it and researching it, but now I feel morally obligated as a scientist, knowing what I know, to actually stop it. So when I received the Heinz Award in 2011 for my research and writing on environmental health, I donated the cash award that came with that, this nice $100,000 check, to the anti-fracking movement of New York, out of my desire not just to study the issue, but to actually protect people, to intervene in a precautionary way. And that money became the seed money for New Yorkers Against Fracking, which I'm really pleased to say has now become, started out just as an alliance of a handful of groups, and now is a kind of a mighty, the little engine that could, that became this sort of mighty force. Now we're more than 200 different organizations, 500 different church leaders, 1,000 different businesses. We have, Poets Against Fracking, Students Against Fracking, Chefs for the Marcellus, and scientists and physicians have joined. And so we have become a voice for the anti-fracking movement in New York, and we really seek to not just say no to fracking, but to bring data out before our policymakers, before our governor, before the people, to show that we could turn our state into a showcase for renewable energy and help our farmers supplement farm income by, for example, having a solar array in their back 40 instead of a drill head, and contribute renewable energy to the grid. We could plug in our electric cars into that grid and so on. But we actually have good data that this is now workable, and we wish to now actualize and operationalize these good ideas. So on June 17th, New Yorkers Against Fracking is going to be rallying in Albany, June 17th being the day that the Statue of Liberty first arrived on our shores 128 years ago. And now we're going to use the anniversary of her arrival to say that New York once again wishes to, raise the lamp to the world to show a path to renewable energy. So we're at a crossroads here. We want to close the door on ruinous fossil fuel extraction, just as we years ago helped close the door on slavery, and redesign our economy so we're no longer dependent on these things that are harming our children and killing the planet.
All right, Sandra. Lastly, let me just ask how your kids. I mean, from I assume you've obviously spoken to your children about your work, and they speak of it. But how do they perceive it? I mean, we've heard it, from your perspective, and you also mentioned a story of a teacher, and I cannot remember what the time was, but talking to her class regarding their perception whether they'll end up dying in a nuclear war. But and I imagine
right.
that
yeah, that's been a very animating story. I mean, I won't. I mean, look, I'm not going to say everything's all sunshine and roses in my household. For sure, there are conflicts. I mean, next week I'll be at a press conference about fracking, and for that, I will miss my son's spring concert, and he doesn't even know that yet. I haven't broken the news to him yet, and I feel terrible about that issue. On the other hand, in a larger way, my kids feel reassured by my activism, knowing that I'm on the job. And, of course, kids always feel that their parents are sort of capable of more than we really are. They sort of think of us as superheroes. So I'm always interested in, like, living up to my kids' belief in the power they think I have. So for them, it's very ordinary. You know, I might come home from Washington or from Albany. I've been testifying or I've been, you know, doing research or whatever I'm doing, and I'll walk in the door, sort of my, you know, sword dragging in the dust, and they'll look up from their homework and say, okay, hi, Mom, have you stopped fracking yet? You know, they, as though I were fully capable of doing that. And that calms them down because they can see that I'm working on their behalf. So for all of their kind of grumbles about my absence, and I certainly do a lot of homework, you know, over the phone from hotel rooms and things like that. But I do remember the story that one of my readers told me about a third grade teacher who, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, when our relationships with the Soviet Union couldn't have been worse, right, and people were really half thinking this was it, that the bombs were going to start flying, that her third grade class was so freaked out that they could not even go through their lessons. And so she began a conversation with them and realized during that conversation that every one of these eight-year-olds thought that they were going to die in a nuclear war, except for one child. And she asked that one child, well, how come you think everything's fine? And she said, because my parents are peace activists and they're going to stop it. So with that story, I began to realize, you know, my job as a parent is not to come up with the perfect narrative about climate change. Like, you know, it's my job to come up with the story of where babies came from. I don't have to come up with the perfect story that's, you know, just alarming but not too alarming about climate change. I don't have to do that. All I have to do is go out and stop it and have my kids watch me and witness me in action. That's what calms them down, is seeing that their parents are engaged, that they aren't turning away from the big moral issues of our time. They're really the heroes of the story, and our kids want us to be heroes, so let's just go do it. It's going to require heroic action. This is a really big problem, but who doesn't want to be a hero? And now here's our chance. And so all kinds of other parents throughout history have had to do heroic things when they had young kids. So I'm always interested in their stories, like how did the French people in the French Resistance do it? How did the abolitionists who ran the Underground Railroad do it? They had kids too, sometimes a lot more than I did, right? And they didn't even have a washing machine. So how did they manage that? And so I think we can do it too. I really do.
Sandra Steingraber, the book is Raising Elijah, Protecting Our Children in an Age of Environmental Crisis. Thanks so much for spending the time today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, we are going to take a quick break, head into the second half of the program. We will put a link up to the book. At the very least, I think we've already linked to Sandra Steingraber's site coming up in the so-called better half of the program. More on the subpoena from the Department of Justice, which supposedly Eric Holder played no part in, and also the introduction, the reintroduction, I should say, of the Shield Law. The sputtering out of Benghazi. New numbers from the CBO. The budget deficit has fallen even more than was predicted just a couple of months ago. Will that stop austerity? No. And a strike in Milwaukee against fast food stores. On and on. Also, a new app that is out that helps you to avoid buying stuff from people you don't want to buy stuff from. Intriguing, I know, Matt. We'll also talk about...
I actually have not heard of this app. I'm very interested in hearing about it.
Yeah. It's very rare that I hear of anything technological before Matt does.
I'm shocked, too.
Well, don't get too carried away. Folks, on the program tomorrow, Cliff Schechter will be taking a much-needed vacation. I will be joined by Ari Berman and then also Jim Gaffigan. Sort of keeping up the parental theme. He's got five kids. Comedian. Apparently he's huge. I mean, it's a big deal. I'm so out of it. I don't really follow it. Somebody has suggested, like, you should get Gaffigan on after Saul was born because he's got five kids. But, you know,
maybe someone could put some perspective into things.
I read a page of his book because just the first couple of pages because they put the first chapter on. It's genuinely funny. I mean, he's a funny guy, but it's genuinely funny. All right, folks, you can support this program by becoming a member. What your support will buy, it will ensure that this show continues. It will, hopefully, if enough of you become members, it will allow us to bring in more personnel, which means that we will have a even broader reach in terms of the types of guests that we can bring on, in terms of scheduling them. And in terms of our technology and in terms of our marketing so that we can seed the show in more places, that we can amplify the voices of the activists or the reporters or the storytellers that we have on this program. And on top of that, it'll buy you an extra 40 minutes a day if that's what you're interested in. 50 minutes. But become a member simply because you like what you hear in that first and the stuff that we give you for free, because you have the ability to make it better and to ensure that it continues, for that matter. All right, folks. Oh, also, you can also support this program by buying your crap from Amazon. If you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link. We have now, through the wonders of technology, placed the link on the front page of majority.fm. So you simply scroll down. You'll see it at the bottom of the page. There's a little Amazon logo with a Majority Report logo in there. Click it. Bookmark it.
You shouldn't even need to go to the front page if you've already bookmarked it. You should be already using
it. Right, but some people say to me, we can't find it because it's on the second page or the third page. You got to click. Now you don't have to do that. Now this is so easy, it's almost embarrassing.
If you're not using that link, then, I mean, what are you doing?
And we've got some good response from folks on in places like Reddit. If you are a regular Reddit user, we will put you on our distribution list. And we'll send you the stuff that we're clipping as part of our YouTube channel. If you want to subscribe to our YouTube channel, do that as well. But if you're on other sites, Democratic Underground, I don't know what other sites are out there and you want to get on that list, send us an email and put it in the subject heading. I've been told we're about 10 days away from the app, but I don't know if I believe it, folks.
10 days?
I can't even begin to tell you. All right, we're going to take a break. See you in the better half. You can call us 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. Is the number if you want to be a part of the program, or you can IM me at Majority FM. See you then.